thank you for coming along to this session from Select. My name is David Stewart. I'm the head of distribution for Select Asset Management. Also in the room, we've got Dominic McCormick somewhere, who's our chief investment officer, and also Stephen Barbridge, who's one of our business development managers. So we'd love to have a chat to you over the course of the next couple of days. There are lots of familiar faces in the room, and obviously some of you who are embracing alternatives already. For those of you who aren't, hopefully today we'll give you a good indication or some ideas on how you can implement alternatives into a balanced portfolio for your clients. We're getting a lot of interest in what we're doing at the moment, and the key reason for that is that as markets are very volatile, one of the things that we look to do is generate returns from different sources. And we use a multi-manager approach as part of our investment process. Rob won't really talk about the investment process. I'll talk a little bit about our products at the end of the presentation. But a lot of interest because we are generating relatively good returns at the moment, and in fact, since inception, about 11% out of this portfolio. So without further ado, I'll pass you to Robert Grahamsmith. Robert is the portfolio manager for the alternatives portfolio. He joined Select in August 2004 and has been in the market for about 14 years. Spent around about 6 years with Deutsche as a senior analyst on their hedge fund-to-fund business, and has a background as a chartered accountant. So really what Rob wants to talk about today is putting alternatives into a portfolio, how to blend alternatives into a diversified portfolio. So without further ado, please welcome Robert.
Well, thanks Andy, and thanks for everyone for coming along today. A pretty full room, which is very, very pleasing. So I hope I'll be able to live up to expectations and deliver some interesting and thought-provoking materials today. So really what I'll cover today is an overview of alternative investments, exactly what they are and their performance in various market crises historically. Then get on to the nuts and bolts of today, which is where they fit in a portfolio, some things to think about in constructing a portfolio, including alternatives and analysis of their investment drivers, some performance measurement and risk management issues, and the all-important question, the sizing of alternative investment allocations. So, I think it's a bit of an understatement that 2007-2008 has obviously been a tremendously challenging environment for most investors and most people with exposure to the markets. I think it's fair to say that those that have been hurt in the last 12 months or so, those that have relied historically upon very heavily on past performance of equity markets, very easy credit conditions that we've witnessed over the last few years, and in many cases, excessive leverage. This time last year, I was at the Portfolio Construction Conference talking about the risks of the unfolding subprime crisis and the dangers involved in making the case for alternative investments. So today, I won't focus on what is happening. Rather, I just really want to focus on how to assist you in helping your clients get exposure to some investment areas that can have the potential to protect capital and preserve wealth in this type of environment and generate returns less reliant on traditional market sources. I'd like to start off firstly just really looking at the losses that have been experienced in Aussie equities, global equities, unhedged, in US dollars, and Australian listed property. And, we all know that these markets have gone down. But, one thing I'd like you to think about is if you look at the very bottom of the slide under the chart, there's a percentage required to get back to the break-even point. And a lot of people seem to forget that if, for example, you lose 50% of your capital in an investment, the requirement is actually for it to generate 100% return to get back to that break-even level. So it's the magic of compounding, but in reverse. So, I think that's a really, really important point and why we are particularly focused on capital preservation. I think what we've seen has really seen, it has led to an overdue reassessment of risk and particularly portfolio diversification. I think over the last few years, people have tended to become very, very complacent in terms of their asset allocation and reliant on, a concentrated source of returns in their portfolios. But during this time, some investors have refrained from chasing the markets and have been allocating significant portions of their portfolios to alternative investments. You know, some examples here are US endowment funds, US family offices, and global high net worth investors. Also, there are many pension funds and superannuation funds, both in Australia and globally, who have embraced alternative investments. In the current environment, we've seen many of them reaping the rewards from that. You know, I think it's a case that Australian advisors and money managers that haven't allocated to alternatives or have only made a small allocation to date are the most vulnerable in the current environment because they're very narrowly diversified. And they're increasingly being requested to do so by their clients, is to seek this greater diversification. And of course, everyone's chasing better returns in this type of environment. You know, one area that everyone, well, is quite often referred to is US endowment funds. They historically have been very, very big supporters of, and very early adopters in some cases, particularly Yale and Harvard and, you know, some of the more eminent endowment funds. And, you know, what I've done here is just gathered the results of an annual survey that's done of, last year it was 785 endowment funds in the US with across the board a dollar-weighted average allocation to alternatives of 32%. And you can see that they have been increasing their allocation to alternatives over the last 10 years quite significantly. Really the highlights of this slide are the second line down is to show the performance of the funds over 1, 3, 5 and 10 years. On a dollar-weighted average basis, they've outperformed both equity and bond markets, and more importantly, I think a lot of them particularly focused on inflation. And also, this, you know, some of this encompasses the large bear market that we've seen in equities as well. So, you know, this goes some way to proving, you know, the outcomes of pretty sizable allocations to alternatives. I think it's also fair to say in the Australian market, there are some barriers historically and continue to be, perceptions of some barriers to investment in alternatives, including, obviously a lack of familiarity with areas outside traditional markets. Liquidity remains a challenge in some cases. I'll talk about that a little bit later on. Some people are less equipped to research and access a broad range of these types of opportunities. But, you know, we feel very strongly at Select that this can be mitigated by, a focus on the outcomes and the potential preservation of capital for clients. Listed alternatives are a very important part of what we do and are a potential solution for particularly the retail market. And, there are solutions available where you can access ready-made diversification across a range of alternative investments. So when I talk about alternative investments, some people think of alternatives just as hedge funds. There's quite a degree of knowledge or lack thereof in the market. This is really just a roadmap of the way that Select sees the alternative investment universe working. And I guess 2 points here is that we divide the universe into two areas: alternative strategies on the left-hand side, which are predominantly hedge funds and trading funds, and on the right-hand side, alternative assets, which are in many cases long-only or bought exposure to non-traditional market returns and risks. Areas such as private equity, commodities, precious metals and gold, infrastructure, and a growing range of other alternatives. The other key point on this slide really I want to make is that within each of these areas, there is you have the ability to diversify even further. So my point here really is that within what is often considered a very, very niche area, you're actually able to get quite significant diversification across a range of risks and returns. Historically, alternatives, I guess it's interesting to look at history and see how alternatives have performed in a range of market crises. These are some of the ones that I've picked out of my paper that I've written. There were four more market crisis periods in the paper, but for, the interests of keeping the presentation short, I've picked out the big ones. And really this illustrates the performance of global equity markets and global bond markets in various crises and how alternative investments represented by indices in this case have done. And, you know, the results are interesting. And one thing I'd ask you to note is on the left-hand side of each chart, the axis does change. So, you know, it reflects the severity of the each individual crisis. You know, I think if you look at that chart, you know, there's some interesting results. And I think whilst protecting capital in many cases, alternative investments have performed differently in various crises, and in some cases have actually performed poorly. So an example is hedge funds during the Russian debt default and following long-term capital management crisis, and unlisted private equity during 2002-2003 bear market globally. I think, you know, there's a few points to take away from that. You know, that the breadth of diversification across alternative investments is important. So it's useful I think it's important not to rely too much on one particular asset alternative strategy or asset class. One other point I'd like to make, though, is that over-reliance on historical data is obviously dangerous, and I'll talk about this a bit more later on. What we do feel very strongly, though, is that alternative investments do have the ability to protect capital, and on a diversified basis particularly so. And what I've done in this chart is to develop a proxy alternatives portfolio. So there's no diversification, optimisation involved, no smoke and mirrors. It's just an evenly split blend of those alternative strategies and assets that I went through before into a naive portfolio, and shown that against international equities on an unhedged basis from 1999 to March 2008. And, you know, I think what it does show is, and this chart shows the drawdown, so this is essentially a loss of capital chart. What it does show is that even a very naively diversified range of alternative investments has the potential to protect capital for investors, and is not necessarily correlated to mainstream markets. So, are alternative investments suitable for all? Obviously, it depends on individual circumstances, but I think increasingly it's yes. The answer is yes for all, but the most aggressive investors, those that have the appetite and the stomach to ride through various market cycles with a very, very traditional asset allocation framework, or the most conservative investors that are seeking cash-like performance over the very long term. So, you know, those that aren't looking to take any risk at all. I think, you know, the declining markets that we've seen in 2007 and 2008 are, you know, the starting point of reasons to allocate to alternatives. But other reasons include potential for inflation mitigation and investment in real assets, things like commodities and gold. Capital preservation, as the previous chart showed. And importantly, a reduction in volatility or a smoother ride for your clients in periods of market stress like we're experiencing at the moment. So really, the three hard questions that people ask, and this really gets to the crux of the presentation today, is how do I go about constructing a portfolio incorporating alternatives? What are the risks involved? And how much should I allocate? You know, unfortunately, there's no silver bullet or magic answer to these questions. It does depend on, obviously, your appetite for risk and return and your existing asset allocation. But hopefully today I'll be able to give you some pointers and some things to think about. And certainly, you know, we're more than happy to talk about these issues with investors. So the bottom part of this chart really revisits the spectrum of available investments in terms of their cost and their potential for alpha generation. And on the far left-hand side, you've got very traditional investments, so index funds and some ETFs that are not looking for, you know, a large degree of tracking error or market risk outside the index. In the middle, traditional but active, so long only, you know, think about your Aussie equity funds, that type of thing. And on the far right-hand side, a range of alternative investments across private markets, real assets, some directional alternatives, the alternative beta, you know, things like commodities or timber, some non-directional alternatives, so more market-neutral investments where the market risk is hedged out and, you know, very focused on delivering alpha from manager skill, and a mix of directional and non-directional, so more long biased. Long-short equity is a good example of that. So, you know, the reason why I'm highlighting those various areas, you know, there's two potential approaches you can take to alternative asset allocation. We're not saying they're the only way, but, you know, I think there are some definitely some things to take away from this. The first is a core satellite approach where you've got your core asset allocation across a range of more traditional investments, whether they're index funds, ETFs, or active managers, but in traditional markets, surrounded by a satellite approach, you know, a range of alternative investments. I think a generalisation is that the core is generally a lower cost, and increasingly, you know, there's a massive availability of ETFs, index funds, that low-cost core, and they can be supplemented by higher cost in some cases, but not always, satellites. So these are the alternatives that you can supplement a traditional portfolio with. And in terms of the percentage allocation to each, I'll come back to that later on. The second approach that you know, has been increasingly suggested by, you know, various research is more a goals-based or a behavioural asset allocation approach, which may not fit that well with investment theory purists, but from a practical perspective has some really good merits. You know, the basic approach there is that you break your overall portfolio into sub-portfolios, and the construction of each sub-portfolio is based on specific client goals or time horizons, and using or supplementing each of these underlying areas with a different mix or different asset classes to reach those specific goals. So, you know, some examples are in property, you can supplement that with infrastructure or agriculture, you know, property or land or timber-based agricultural investments. In equities, you know, it doesn't have to be long-only equities. You can use long-short equity, private equity, or even sector-specific exposures. I guess, you know, these are just some thoughts on potential supplements to things that you might already be investing in. You know, as I said, from an investment theorist perspective, it may not sit well, but from a practical implementation, you know, it really does, you know, ring true, and, you know, there are some benefits from doing this. However, I think it's really important to think about idiosyncratic or single manager risk, liquidity and taxation. This sort of framework doesn't take that into account, and I'll talk more about the risks later on. One other point we'd like to make, is on growth and defensive alternative investments. We don't think it's a great idea to classify all alternatives as either growth or defensive. Many different underlying investments have different exposures, performance objectives, and differing use of leverage. You know, two examples of those are market neutral hedge funds are very, very different from macro or very directional hedge funds. Another example is regulated infrastructure, you know, so regulated by the government, versus greenfield or very immature infrastructure assets. You know, I think a very important note that structuring and illiquidity, so in some cases mark to model or not mark to market assets, can make some investments look less risky than they really are. And that's a very important point. And I'll come back to that again later on in the presentation. One key, though, and I've mentioned this already, is that a diversified portfolio of alternative assets and strategies can actually exhibit defensive characteristics if it's a very broadly diversified portfolio, if there's a low correlation of the underlying investments to each other and also to the markets. Historically, when people have thought about constructing alternative portfolios and the optimal solution to them, you know, in many cases, people have used historic data to do this. And as I mentioned earlier, this is a pretty dangerous proposition because the history obviously doesn't tell you what will happen in the future. You know, it's a flawed approach, particularly in the alternative investment area, because alternative assets and strategies, the correlation of those investments does vary over time. Many alternative investments do have non-normal distributions, so fat tails on the the distribution or skewed distribution, either to the left or the right. So it's very difficult to use traditional mean variance optimization framework to optimize a portfolio in this space. Those sort of optimizers generally ignore illiquidity of investments completely, so that further complicates this sort of optimization. And the discounts and premiums on some vehicles, for example, listed investment companies, complicates it even further. Now, I think it's important when determining allocations and constructing an optimal or an optimised portfolio of these types of investments, it's appropriate to use, these are our thoughts, longer-term expected return and risk characteristics for each investment. And importantly, the inputs shouldn't be conditional on near-term market conditions or business cycles. It's particularly important to use those over a longer time horizon. So some practical consideration, some dangers from using historical inputs. Now, I think there's a potential for disproportionately high allocations to illiquid investments because they're not subject to those same mark-to-market profiles that obviously listed or strategies that invest in listed markets have. You know, so some examples of those are unlisted infrastructure or, you know, in the more traditional space, direct property. This in turn can, you know, if you add constraints on liquidity, it can artificially cap maximum allocations to this space. So, you know, hence a flawed approach. Some practitioners have suggested forward-looking optimization techniques, and this, you know, we ourselves do quite a bit of work in this area as a tool and a guide rather than to driving our asset allocation decisions. But, you know, it allows you to really think about the future rather than the past. So using estimates of true risk exposures, a factor approach to capture systemic risk characteristics of each investment, looking at forward risk and liquidity premiums, and simulations over a variety of periods, incorporating the cost of liquidity. So that's only rebalancing the portfolio to the extent that you practically can in real life, and the benefits of liquidity, so the liquidity premium. You know, I think forward-looking portfolio construction's intuitively more appropriate, but it isn't easy, hence the temptation for a lot of people to use historical data and constrained optimization. I think it's also important to think about performance and risk management issues. You know, risks obviously vary across a range of different investment options. It's difficult to generalise these without specific examples, and I could talk about this all day, but, given that today's session's reasonably short, you know, I'm happy to talk about some of those outside the presentation. But some factors to consider are potential over-reliance on the Sharpe ratio. You know, a good example, you know, we've seen some good examples of this over the last 12 months where performance of some investments has been very, very steady and exhibited very strong Sharpe ratios, so strong risk-adjusted returns, and then the investments have fallen off the cliff. So I think just relying on a strong Sharpe ratio is a risky proposition. Asymmetric returns, particularly in the alternative space, with a positively or negatively skewed distribution. You know, there's issues with mean variance optimization, as I mentioned. You know, illiquidity, I've already mentioned that. It's difficult to measure the required return premium, and there's a potential for artificially stable and potentially misleading returns. And, you know, the ability of some investments to trend. There are some some alternative risk-adjusted return metrics that some people use, and we have done quite a bit of work on this particular area. Two examples of this are conditional value at risk. So it's an adjusted framework. A normal value at risk framework will tell you that you can expect to lose money in you get a value at risk which tells you you expect your returns to be plus or minus 2%, say in 5% of months. What it doesn't tell you is when those losses occur, how big they will be. So one thing that we focus ourselves very strongly on is the left-hand side of those return distributions, those periods where losses occur, how great that we can expect them to be. So, you know, to us it's very important. Value at risk will tell you how often you can expect to experience losses, but it won't tell you how big those losses will be, whether they'll be 5% or 90%. And another suggested approach is modified VAR, where there's adjustments for skewed distributions. I think overall there are different views and a widespread of manager risks and returns in the alternative investment arena. There's no perfect alternatives mix, but hopefully some of the issues that I've already talked about will give you an idea of some things to think about, and I'll talk about some more practical considerations as well. And I think for investors without an insight into risk management and portfolio construction, it's a pretty difficult proposition to construct broadly diversified alternative investment portfolios. And in some cases, it may be more appropriate for them to use a multi-manager solution. I think, when you're the all-important question, determining the size of allocations, the three key issues for people to consider, our thoughts, are illiquidity. I think it's fair to say that a lot of superannuation funds and endowment funds have access to patient capital, and this allows them to invest in less liquid assets, which aren't available to many retail investors. The size of minimum allocations and limited access make it difficult for retail market to access some areas, and taxation is an important consideration as well. I think, as I mentioned, listed alternatives are a partial solution to the liquidity conundrum. You know, they provide liquidity for illiquid assets in some cases, an efficient structure, the opportunity in many cases to buy at a discount to their net asset backing and benefit from the discount narrowing, and some have tax benefits. But there are some complications as well. I think my final thoughts on diversification, really the key is, if you're thinking about allocating money to alternative investments, you have to make the allocation large enough to make a difference to a portfolio. 5% won't help you. Our view is that a 10 to 30% allocation is a reasonable starting point. It's important to invest across a range of alternative strategies and alternative assets, aiming for low correlation of the investments to each other and to markets. Diversify across themes, strategies, sources of risk and return. And balancing liquidity may be difficult, but it isn't impossible. As I mentioned, there are differences between the structure and style of alternative investments. It may seem a very obvious concept, but it's important to remember that two or more highly volatile investments can actually be complementary when blended together and provide strong risk-adjusted returns. I think it's very important to differentiate between skill-based investments and those relying on risk premiums which may not exist tomorrow. For example, carry trades or credit spread narrowing. We've seen some funds suffer the consequences of that in the last 12 months. Accessing some of the best areas can entail a lot of work, lateral thinking, and some challenges with structure and domicile and tax. Important point, people always talk about hedge fund blow-ups. It's not just hedge funds that blow up. A lot of listed companies do, and brokers as well nowadays. But underlying manager diversification does provide some comfort. So I can't stress enough the diversification element. Make sure that if you're investing in this area, one blow up doesn't cause critical damage to your portfolio. And I think the major challenge for many individuals is diversification across a broad range of alternative investments themselves. So that's it from me. I'm getting the wind up here, but I think it's time for questions.
I'm sure you'll all join me in thanking Robert for that bit. We're going to take some questions now, and we're going to start with David Wright from Zenith, who's going to ask our first question.
Rob, you made the interesting point that alternatives are not necessarily growth or income assets. Mm-hmm. Because in our observation, a lot of people have the misconception that alternatives are all growth assets.
Yep.
So when you're constructing a portfolio,
sure,
are there key characteristics you're looking at as to whether it is a growth-based or income or defensive-based?
Yeah, I think the starting point for us really is, you know, in our portfolio construction, particularly for the alternatives portfolio I look after, is we have a core allocation to very conservative and diversified fund of hedge funds. So that's low return, well, sort of incrementally positive returns, but very low volatility levels. And what we do is actually supplement that with some higher risk or more growthy, I guess, for a want of better description, investment areas. So we take targeted risks in some more slightly more aggressive areas. You know, I think when we get asked this question all the time, are alternatives defensive or growth? I think, and where should I take the allocation from? I think it really makes sense to, if you're going to allocate to alternative investments, to take the allocation from where the most existing risk in your portfolio is. So if you've got a lot of fixed income in your portfolio, you might want to lighten that up, or particularly relevant for most people, I think, is too much equity market exposure. So if you lighten up on that, it really is just a tool for diversification, is our view.
Questions from the audience?
Hi.
I've got a question on correlation.
Sure.
If you're putting a portfolio together, which will include, say, fund of hedge funds and individual managers in different spaces around that, similar to what you say.
Mm-hmm. I guess in the hedge fund space, one, you know, it's a pretty disparate area, but one commonality really is that the standard for pricing hedge funds is monthly. So most, if probably 95% of hedge funds will give you a monthly price. That does allow you to compare like with like, and you know, obviously there are issues with mark to model, but you really have to be mindful of that when you're looking at individual managers. Most hedge fund managers will actually have a degree of mark to market, or you know, if they don't, there are obviously other risks to think about. With the select alternatives portfolio, we price weekly, so we have weekly liquidity on the portfolio. You know, we're very mindful of liquidity risks, and that's why we focus on some of the listed alternatives as well. But to answer your question on the correlation, that's why we tend not to rely on history as much as you would in the traditional space. We're really more concerned about what we think will happen in the future. And, you know, if you do a forward-looking analysis on a portfolio, it's not perfect. You have to make assumptions to do that, and, you know, those assumptions are clearly there. But what it does allow you to do is to, if you get a measure of various investments in your portfolio and how you expect them to operate in certain market conditions, it will give you a forward-looking view of your expected portfolio performance. But importantly, it allows you to stress test your portfolio as well. So in a high inflationary environment, if credit spreads widen significantly, if equity markets collapse, you can, once again, making assumptions, but you know, in a lot of cases, we're pretty conservative and harsh on ourselves, how we'd expect a portfolio to operate in those types of environments. So I agree. You know, there are dangers from using historical data. Sometimes it's difficult to obtain. You know, a lot of hedge funds have been around for a long period of time, but, you know, there are some great managers that don't have long track records either. So it is difficult in a lot of circumstances. So that's what we spend our time doing, and you know, those are the sorts of challenges that we have every day with portfolio construction. I think the key, again, is diversification. So, you know, you just don't want to be too reliant on any one thing in your portfolio.
Up the back.
Your forward-looking data will ultimately become historical data.
Yeah.
So have you got any examples of balanced portfolios
Yeah, I mean, I don't sort of want to talk to our shop specifically, but probably the best example is at Select, we actually run a defensive and a growth portfolio as well. And they have, depending on how you measure it, around a 30% allocation to alternative investments. They've got a five and a half year track record now. Broadly speaking, you know, we've been swimming against the tide of rising equity markets, and we haven't had as high an allocation to equities and a lot of traditional investments that have done well until the last 12 months. But if you look back over time historically, the correlation of those portfolios to mainstream, to say Aussie equity markets, I haven't run the numbers for a little while, but last time we did it was around 4 or 5 months ago, and I feel that the numbers would be a lot even better now. The correlation of our growth portfolio, for example, to Aussie equity markets is around 0.6, or it was about 6 months ago. I think it would be lower now because we've been able to preserve capital. If you look at, not picking on anyone in particular, but if the Vanguard sort of balanced option, you know, they're an index manager, so a good proxy. I think if you use the Morningstar median manager as well, their correlation to Aussie equity markets over that sort of 5 year period was about 0.9. So we've been about 0.6, they've been about 0.9. So that really just does show you we've had a lot less reliance on traditional markets, and during that time have been able to generate attractive risk-adjusted returns with lower drawdowns, and you know, really demonstrate, as you say, the benefits from a diversified portfolio perspective of investing in alternatives. Does that sort of answer your question?
Yeah, I guess really from a practitioner's point of view, you really want to see some historical data to say, well, okay, is this a strategy that has got some value for clients?
Sure. Well, I mean, that's sort of some of the tools that we can, you know, we help investors and potential investors with, because it is a hard area, and alternative investments haven't been around as long as traditional markets, so it's difficult to go back too far in time. But you know, that's definitely something we can talk to you about. But history does give you some guidance, but you know, there are issues as well. So,
and one more very quick question.
Just one of the problems with hedge funds for us is that obviously always it's fees, you know,
sure.
2%, 20%,
yep.
Zero. You know, they say they have the ability to generate alpha, greater alpha, but really it seems you're just switching beta between beta.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think in time we're going to see fees lower significantly in hedge funds, and that they offer more transparency into actually what they're doing?
That's a great question, and I think the market is developing, and the hedge fund industry is definitely becoming more institutional. What you're seeing, particularly at the moment, is some of the smaller, more marginal hedge fund players are getting squeezed out of the market, and some of the larger, more established hedge funds are getting bigger. Those bigger hedge funds and fund of hedge funds as well have realised that in order to crack the institutional space and work with pension funds and superannuation funds, they have to provide a degree of transparency and get investors more comfortable. So there is a massive range. You know, some hedge funds are very non-transparent. Some are very transparent and, you know, happy to work with their investors. It is a huge range, but it is a continuing challenge. With the fees, I think what you're seeing is the better hedge funds are able to charge higher fees, and emerging managers or new managers are less so. I think, you know, the days of old where the standard startup hedge fund was charging 2% management fee and a 20% performance fee, which is high, they're maybe gone, or it's getting harder for them to do that now. They're getting squeezed, not just by institutional investors, but by fund of hedge funds as well, who negotiate very hard on fees. But, you know, one thing we do try to get people to focus on is net performance net of fees and the net of fees outcome. I know that alternative investments may not be the most fee-friendly space, but, you know, we work hard to get fees down and invest as cheaply as we can. But, you know, bearing in mind that if you invest with low-cost solutions, you don't obviously get the best outcomes. So it is a balance. But net of fee returns, I think, are very important.
We're going to have to finish up there. Before we thank Robert, I'd just like to remind you all that Select have written a paper that goes with this presentation, and that will be up on the website after the conference and would definitely be worth reading to reinforce a lot of the messages in the presentation. So I will hand over to Andrew to sum up.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you for coming along this morning. We appreciate your time. Hopefully that gave you some insight into areas surrounding asset allocation in relation to alternatives. We get asked questions daily by advisors, how do we allocate to this space? And Stephen and I are on the road a lot talking to advisors about what has worked for different plans or different groups as they incorporate alternatives into their portfolios. Groups like Zenith are also out there talking about how to include these kind of assets into a portfolio. So please avail yourselves of our expertise, but if not, and you feel comfortable going for another group, a lot of the researchers are out there doing that kind of work as well. We have a diversified offering. The Select Alternatives portfolio provides you access to a very broad range of alternatives in the marketplace. I think there's a perception with a lot of planners that alternatives, generally speaking, mean high risk, high costs, but potential for higher returns. What we're actually saying, and the way that we manage these portfolios, is to increase diversification and reduce the volatility of portfolios over time. So this is an example of the kind of areas that you get access to. I know Rob's spoken about this with the alternatives portfolio. Hedge funds, an example of a hedge fund that we get access to, Gotex, they're looking to achieve cash plus 2-3% return with a volatility of 2. It's a fixed interest style return profile. Their worst ever month was actually last August when we were at this conference last year, and they did something like negative 2.4% in their flagship fund. It's a low volatility hedge fund, very, very highly diversified. Talking about fees, a lot of those managers in that space are really looking to squeeze the fees at the moment. We will see a reduction in fees over time in this space. Managed futures, we invest with a group called Renaissance globally. One of their funds has got an annualised return of 40% per annum, standard deviation of 17%. Interesting, highly volatile. We've seen managed futures be volatile in the short term. Private equity, commodities, precious metals, gold, infrastructure. So these are highly diversified portfolios. And the one key point that I want to stress is that the way that we generate returns from these portfolios is just from alternative sources. That's the bottom line. If we look, and yes, we are cherry-picking some performance data, but the reason I'm doing that is to look at the performance since the volatility really spiked. As I mentioned, August last year, there were a stack, if you were here, you'd remember at the other venue, there were a stack of advisors looking at screens as equity markets were, you know, super volatile. I think they ended up the month positive for August, but certainly lots of volatility. During that volatile time, you can see the top line there, the Select Alternatives portfolio, has generated a positive return. Now again, I'm not standing up here trying to say we're the best things since sliced bread, but again, the point is that we're generating returns from different sources, and that means that you'll get a different return profile from traditional assets in a portfolio over time. And that's very, very evident when you look at that. The long-term return, I think since inception, the fund has done around about 11%.
Next slide.
Next slide, there we go, 11%. Correlation to the MSCI negative, so it's actually been zero, exactly zero for a long time. So again, when equity markets were powering ahead, one of the things as a business that we were talking about is that a lot of planners were saying, well, why would I have alternatives in the portfolio? Yeah, they're generating 11% since inception when I can get 15% out of the equity market. And again, the point there is to say that we're not trying to generate high returns with high volatility, it's steady as you go. These kind of portfolios should be able to provide good returns when equity markets and other markets are trending upwards, but really they show their mettle when there's volatility in the markets. Correlation to the ASX 200 at the moment is probably around about 0.4.
Yeah, it's come down.
So again, and that correlation has come down over time. Talk about all assets correlating during tough market conditions. Well, again, just the nature of this fund and the underlying assets, it's actually the correlation has come down over time. The last point I want to make is that, again, the feedback we get from a lot of planners is that having weekly liquidity in a portfolio, particularly if you're using these kind of assets within any platform, and our funds are on most of the key platforms in the marketplace, having weekly liquidity makes it a much, much simpler process for you when you're managing liquidity on behalf of your clients. We offer weekly liquidity with this particular fund, and in fact, we are diversified funds as well. So we think that's a big benefit, and it's a clear point of differentiation between this fund and some of the other alternative assets in the marketplace. Again, thank you very much for coming along. Rob, thanks for your presentation. We'll be on the stand. If you want to know more information, we can help you out with correlations, historical data, you name it. Please come and have a chat with us. Thanks for your time.
We are going to take your votes on the presentation now, and then before you go, we're just going to hear from David Wright from Zenith Investment Partners, who's going to sum up for us about what we've heard and the implications of that for constructing portfolios. So if we just move to the voting, if we could start thinking about how this session was. One, two, mediocre. Three good or four excellent, if you could vote now. Don't forget to put your cards in the gizmo. Your time's not really up if you didn't put your card in. You can still do it now.
16 people voted.
Only 16 people voted. Still waiting for votes from some of you. Sorry, it's not reading the card?
Because we need to cut more.
Yeah. Apparently it's not reading the card.
Can we try again? Or?
Can we do it again?
Still recording.
Still recording.
Still recording.
Oh, okay. So you can still put them in if you haven't voted yet. Your vote obviously impacts on whether the session is run again in the afternoon, so we're very keen to get your feedback so that we won't run the best of the sessions in the afternoon. Okay. Oh. And we're now going to hear from David Wright from Zenith Investment Partners.
Thanks, Amanda. I think it was interesting as part of Rob's presentation that broke down alternatives into alternative strategies and essentially alternative asset classes. Because in our observation, there is a practice in the industry that everything that's non-mainstream is just called alternative under this sort of umbrella term. And we don't think that's right. I mean, equity long-short funds in the Australian equity space or in the international space really are just another strategy within that respective asset class, and our view should be used in that asset class. Having said that,